Welcome to Rise Above the Ashes podcast, where we break down the art of failure and learn why multiple failures equals true success if you just don't give up. In this podcast, we go deep with our guests to find out how they overcome some of the greatest obstacles in their lives and what makes them tick as a human being. Learn here how you can turn your failures into true success. All right, everybody, this is Brandon. I am here with my special guest, Mark Evans. How you doing, Mark?
I'm doing good. How are you?
I'm doing good. How's your day today?
It is hot, terrible, muggy, and full of nothing but sweat. Welcome to Georgia, right?
That is Georgia. Georgia's just like my podcast. It's gritty, it's sweaty, and it just makes you want to stink all over. But by the time you get a shower, you feel like $1 million.
All we're missing is the gnats.
Yep. Well, tell me about yourself, Mark. Mark, you are my, let me tell you guys about, let's tell the listeners about who you are. I'll start and then you fill in where I left off. You're my pastor. I love you. You're my movie buddy. We go watch movies. You're just a good friend. We've known each other for a little less than a year, but I just feel like we're kindled spirits and I really enjoy hanging out with you. But tell me a little bit more depth of who you are and what you do.
Well, I'll go way back. I grew up in church. My dad got born again when I was three. So from 3 years old to present age 54, I was all about church. My mom and dad went, they lived it. I mean, it was real. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I never had a thought of, is this thing fake? Is it real? My dad just lived it. He was a businessman, a CPA. He owned his own firm. And then in 1977, dad went into ministry to start a church from scratch. So therefore at 15 years old, again, I'm moving from Alabama to South Georgia near Savannah, Statesboro, Georgia, and kind of just in ministry by default, I guess what you would call it, like in church all the time. So all the way through high school and then through college, I'm in church. Living the good life. Like I had a great family. I've never even heard my dad raise his voice. I've never seen him lose his temper. Same with my mom. I just grew up in a great home. Had it good, I guess, you know, just really stable family, parents always there and teach me spiritual things. And so that's kind of my background. Just a good dude, you know, had a good life. I would even brag at times of, and I just got it really good. Like I just have grown up well. I think my parents really instilled in me how to handle life, you know, don't ever quit, don't give up. I even remember coming home one time with an F on a report card when I was in high school. I had flunked a math test and, you know, my dad said, well, did you try your best? And I'm like, yeah, I tried my best. I just can't do it. And he said, well, sit down and I'll help you. He said, you don't have to worry about a failure. He said, we'll have another opportunity. And so, you know, even from that age, I was just always, don't ever give up. Mm. Don't ever quit. You know, don't ever throw in the towel. Mm. Even when I spent a little time in the fire industry, in the fire department, you know, being a firefighter, that same thing, just don't ever quit. Don't ever give up, which has great potential, right? Until you find yourself backed in a corner, which is probably why you've asked me to be on here is I found myself at that point.
Right. Well, tell me a little bit about the fire department. How was the fire department for you?
Well, I actually started with the chief was a friend of mine, and he asked me if I would come and just pray about being a chaplain. And I'm like, well, sure. I don't even know what that means, but I'll do it. Well, in the being the chaplain, they felt like, hey, we want to take you through the fire academy and get you all credentialed and probably have better input. So I did. I went through all the, and got a fire degree, took all the classes, hazmat classes, fire classes. And really got into it for the spiritual benefit of helping people, but ended up loving it so much that I, you know, spent a little stint of about 3 years just being a chaplain, working at the fire department as well, and helping as a volunteer and touching a lot of guys. It was fun.
Was that part of your makeup DNA right there where you didn't give up and then you became a firefighter and it taught you how to keep going more persistent even through, like you had a sermon yesterday, you were talking about just keep going and you just felt like you were dying and just couldn't get up and move on. And why don't you tell us a little bit about that story?
Yeah, we would do training, right? So every day at 6 o'clock, we would do training. So I'd show up in the morning before I would go to work, we would spend an hour and a half training and sometimes during the afternoon as well. And so this time we were training and it was hard. I mean, it's not your typical, you know, long before CrossFit, I should say. This was, I mean, we're flipping tires, moving all kind of stuff. And I was just spent, but they had a bell that you could ring and the chief would tell you, hey, you want to check out, ring the bell. You can quit anytime you want. Just go over and ring the bell. And so on this day, man, I'm just like, I'm never ringing the bell. I don't care what you do to me. I'm not a bell ringer, no matter what you do. And so I find myself laying on the floor. I was so tired. I was worn out. I was spent. I had nothing left. And I'm crying. Like, I'm laying on the floor in full gear as a grown man, just sobbing. And I'm like, I'm not ringing the bell. I'm just not ringing the bell. And, you know, he's standing over me kind of taunting as a friend, but at the same time trying to inspire me to keep going. And well, 2 years in, you know, I always bragged about it. I'm like, nah, man, I'm never ringing the bell. You're going to have to carry me out on a stretcher. So even, I think even then, you know, that mentality of, I'm just not going to quit. I don't care how hellacious it gets, how hard it gets. If I have to cry my way through it, pout my way through it, I'm just, you might even have to drag me out, but I'm not giving up. So, you know, that has pluses and minuses to it. You know, if you're in something that you need to quit, but your mentality is I'm never going to quit, it ends up hurting you, your family, everything else. So there comes a great wisdom on this thing of don't ever quit. And, you know, now at 54, my comment is, well, sometimes you need the wisdom to quit. You need to know when to say no to something that's destroying you and something that's killing you. And then you need to have the wisdom to know when not to quit, to say, no, this is not killing me. I'm killing myself.
Right.
I need to rise above it. Like you say, you know, rise above the ashes here.
Yeah. Well, so you were leaving a perfect transition. So let's go to your younger self, like when you were 10 years old and you saw a movie about a guy dying. Tell me about that feeling, what you experienced. And I already know a little bit, but let's share it with the audience.
Well, it's weird, right? You're 10 years old and I'm just watching a movie. Of course, back then there's no remote control, so you can't just change it. So you had to be really, you know, astute to get up off the couch and go over and click the UFC button, you know, to try to UHF button to try to change it over. And so I found myself typically watching cartoons and things like that, but I landed on a movie called Death Be Not Proud. And it was a Robbie Benson was in the movie. I'm 10 years old. He gets a brain tumor in the movie and I'm thinking, hey, he's going to get healed. He'll be okay. And he goes to the doctor and they do all the tests and they say, yeah, you're okay. Well, fast forward to scene, he dies, you know. And as a 10-year-old kid, man, you wouldn't think that one movie could profoundly impact you. But when I saw him die as a kid in the movie, I had a thought, a weird thought. And the weird thought was this, if he could die, you could die. Mm-hmm. And you'd think I'd just get up and go live life, but I couldn't get that thought out of my head. Mm-hmm. It just went over and over and over. If he can die, you can die. If he can die, you can die. And maybe for a 10-year-old kid, that's not a big deal. But I remember my mom asking me one time, she said, why do you keep touching your head? And I said, I'm just making sure I don't have a brain tumor. And she starts laughing. She said, well, why would you have a brain tumor? And I said, well, I watched this movie. And, you know, for everybody else, it was kind of a joke. But for me as a kid, it literally had embedded itself so deep in my thinking that it just went over and over and over and over. You know, if he could die, you could die. And, you know, I would try to just shake it. Like, it even affected me so much, I didn't want to go spend the night at a friend's house. I'm like, nah, man, I don't know. You know, I mean, and I wasn't really thinking, is this a psychological thing? Is it just fear? I mean, I'm too young to know that. Mm. I just know it bothered me. It bothered me a whole lot, like to the point that I wouldn't go to people's house. I wouldn't stay away from home. I mean, it lent itself into camp experiences as a kid growing up, going off, going, man, what if I die? What if I, you know, I don't want to jump off this diving board. What if I die? What if I, you know, I mean, just, and then once you don't stop it, it just becomes a whirlwind. Everything is impacted by the thought. Mm. And I think that's where I've started learning how powerful, because, you know, in my later years, I ended up writing a book called Fireflies on the Bedpost about the power of that thought.
Right.
Because that thought stayed with me 20 years, right? Who would have ever thought from 10 to age 30 that I would be having to deal with panic attacks, fear, torment, laying in bed thinking, what if I die? And the thing that really happened, that fast forward from 10 years old till I was 23, I'm married and my wife gets killed in a car wreck by a drunk driver.
Yeah.
And all that did was magnify the fear.
Open up a can of worms.
More than a can. I mean, it was like a semi truck of, well, if all the way back to that movie happened, and then this, it's amazing how life will trigger you, like events can trigger you. Because I was in college doing pretty good, still struggling with the thoughts, but you know, I called it manage. I'd learned how to manage the panic and learn how to manage the thoughts. And I saw one of my best friends on the sidewalk. He was walking down the sidewalk and I had this weird feeling like I need to talk to him, you know, because I was not the overt pushy Christian, you know, like I'm in your face, you better get Jesus. You know, I was just not that guy. I was the kind of the guy that I love Jesus. If you do, great. If you don't, great. It's not my call. But I saw him walking down the sidewalk that day and I had this weird thought, I need to talk to him and tell him Jesus loves him. I just had that overwhelming thought. So I did. And he just looked at me and kind of laughed. And, you know, I mean, we knew each other. So it's just like, yeah, right, Mark. What? Okay. And he just walked off. And 2 days later, he was dead. He died in a car wreck, drunk driving.
Oh, man.
So I'd already lost him. And so, you know, that was just another trigger. Yeah. I just killed your friend. I can kill you anytime I want. Those were the thoughts.
And your wife had gotten killed in a car
1989, wreck. My wife gets killed on a Friday morning in a car wreck, got hit by a drunk driver. So now these thoughts are much less of just a thought.
Okay.
I believe that they're reality.
Right.
And I think that's where the real problem with people comes in, is because the thought is so embedded, it just becomes your reality.
Yeah.
Well, he died, she died, I'm next. It's a guarantee.
Yeah.
And man, you're talking about rising from the ashes. That's a mental distress and torment is a heap of ashes.
Yeah.
It affects your mental state, your marriage, your kids, your sexual state, your physical state, just the mental side of it. You basically just want to lay in bed or you want to just hide, you know? Mm. And I became good at faking it, I think. Especially when your mentality is don't ever quit.
Right.
So I think a lot of times there's a lot of people who won't quit, but they're really just faking it.
Right.
Because man, on the outside, I will never quit. But on the inside, I'm a raging mess. My marriage is hurting. My life is hurting. My emotions are hurting. My job is hurting. But all of a sudden people walk in the room and see you and it's like, oh, it's time to put on the facade. You know?
Yeah.
And I think that's hard for people, especially people driven to succeed. It's hard to open up and be transparent and go, yeah, you know, man, this side of my life really sucks.
Right.
So it's just a lot easier to just fake it and keep everything at a superficial level.
Yeah.
You know, and I think that's, to me, what's so important about deep friendships.
Mm-hmm.
Because when you have a friend that can go deep, you know, in your life and that's going to stick with you regardless, I think in those times you can really open up and go, dude, yeah, I got to have some help.
Yeah.
You know, because once you admit I need help to get above the ashes, it tells you, well, I'm weak.
Right.
And most men don't like to raise their hand and go, oh, yeah, dude, I'm the weak guy. Yeah, I'm the guy struggling here.
I don't mind it.
Yeah. Well, I don't now, right? I mean, once you kind of walk through the hell, you're like, yeah, I'd just much rather tell people up front,
right.
You know, dude, here you go. This is the real me.
Okay.
You know, not make excuses for it, but be open about it.
Yeah. So you were gripped by fear. It created a stronghold. You watched a gentleman die. You saw your wife die in a car wreck. Won't you elaborate more on the story of what you experienced when your wife, Monica, passed away?
Well, you know, first is guilt.
You're 24 years old and you're what, like 4 years married maybe?
Yeah, 4.5 years married.
Okay.
So I'm laying in bed the night before and I can't sleep. And I get up and think, well, I can't sleep. I'm going to brush my teeth or something. You know, I just couldn't sleep. So there's no, you know, I mean, this is the early 80s. So there's no computers. There's no cell phones. I couldn't go, you know, play Candy Crush, you know, to kill time. So I just thought, well, I'll brush my teeth and just try to see what's going on. And I remember brushing my teeth. This is May 18th, 1989. I was in the bathroom brushing my teeth. And I looked in the mirror. Exact words, I said this to myself, man, something's really bothering you.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't know what it was. I just had this weird, man, something's bothering you. And I just looked in the mirror at myself and thought, oh, well, I just got a busy day tomorrow. You know? And I walked back in the bedroom where Monica was sleeping And I looked over at her and I thought, well, I don't know what's going on, but I just have a weird feeling. I went to bed. She woke up that morning, just like every other Friday morning. She said, I'm going to go to Augusta with some friends. And I said, yeah, I'll see you this afternoon. And it was 10 o'clock in the morning. I got the phone call, you know, she was dead. And I'm telling you, man, it, you know, that the day is weird. Like, you know, you look back and I get the phone call and they say, well, you need to come to the hospital. And I say, well, is she alive? And they say, well, we can't give out that information on the phone. You just need to get here as quickly as possible.
That's going to be devastating.
Yeah. So the whole way I'm driving, there's a 45-minute drive to the hospital where she was. I actually passed the van that she was riding in, and it was so mangled, I thought it was a pickup truck because I looked at it and thought, wow, somebody really had a bad wreck. And I'm not even thinking her because they didn't even lend to me that she's dead. They just said, you just need to get here. And so I got to the hospital, and man, nothing like TV, right? I mean, what you see on TV versus what you experience, because I get to the hospital and they send me into a little room, probably 12 feet by 12 feet. And suddenly I open my eyes, you know, because I'm kind of like, what's going on? Like, somebody give me some information. And they just whisk me off to this room. And about five nurses walk in and a surgeon walks in. And I could just tell something's wrong. Like,
is there like a presence in the room? Like, you just feel a fog?
Everything. Yeah. I mean, just funk, just like the whole thing is shifting. Like something's not right. Nobody's telling me what's going on. And then that's when the doctor, he said, Mr. Evans, we tried everything we could, but we couldn't save your life, your wife. We did all we could do medically and she's dead. And then I immediately responded, no, she's not dead. He said, yes, Mr. Evans, she's dead. And that we did all we could do. We're so sorry. Of course, they really went into very empathetic and compassionate. You know, the nurses were trying to console me. And then I don't know, man. I it's not like I had a script, right? Like I wasn't looking at a book going, okay, let's see part two, do this. I just said, well, all I know is that she will be alive. And they said, no. And I said, yes, she can come back. And they said, no, Mr. Evans, she's not coming back.
Yeah.
And I said, well, one day she will, because Jesus, he came back. And I know one day. And they just kind of looked at me funny. And I said, one day she'll come back, because I believe in Jesus. And then I just said, can I pray for y'all? And they looked at me like I was an idiot.
You said, can you pray for the doctors?
For all of them, the nurses? Yeah, because they were in the room. I said, can I just pray for y'all? And they said, yeah, sure.
Why would you pray for them?
I have no clue.
Okay.
Other than the room was so tense. Yeah. Like the nurses were tearing up. The doctor was tense to share the news. I think they knew I was tense. So I don't even think, I wasn't even thinking this is a religious exercise. Yeah. I'm just, that's all I could think to do is, okay, I'm just going to pray for them.
So you had like adrenaline running. Your first thought was maybe possibly denial. And then like, she's going to come back again. And now you're at the point where I just got to release. Like, all I know is to pray.
Yes. So, because nobody was there with me. A secretary was there, but she was still out in the lobby and I'm in the room with all these people. Mm-hmm. And so they said, sure. And so I said, well, grab hands. And so we all grabbed hands and I just went around and prayed for all of them. I just laid my hand on the head of the nurses and I called because they had their tags on. And I said, God, I ask you to bless this nurse and this doctor. And then I said this, I said, and they don't have any guilt. They did everything they could do to save my wife. And I bless them. And I ask you to bless their life and that they will never have any guilt from this day. And then about 2 seconds later, after the prayer, the coroner walks in and of course they whisk me down to the room to identify her body. And, you know, I mean, who wants, I always tell people, it's just nothing like Hollywood.
Yeah.
They're, you know, cause now.
Sucks.
It just sucks. Yeah. Cause my wife is in this little, 12 by 8 room. I mean, it's a long, skinny room, you know, 16 by 8 feet maybe. And she's on a gurney still under, you know, a sheet. And the coroner walks me in and he says, well, we need you to identify, is this your wife? And so they pulled the sheet off and sure enough, it was her. And
What was your immediate reaction?
What the hell? You know, yeah. I mean, just being raw with you. I mean, it's just, what's going on? Like, and so in the moment, I'm not sitting there, I'm not mad at anybody. I'm not mad at a drunk driver because at that point I don't even know it's a drunk driver.
Yeah.
I just feel alone. I just feel there's, so I say to the coroner, I said, do you mind if I have a minute with her. And he goes, no, Mr. Evans, I'll be right outside the door. Whatever you need, you just knock on the door, come get me. He went out. So I was left there just looking at my wife and, you know, that whole thing, don't ever give up, right? Yeah. I mean, don't ever quit. And so I'm sitting here looking at something going, well, this is over. I mean, something's got to change. And so I thought, well, I'm just going to do what I think I could do. And so I just prayed a prayer and I said, God, I said, if my wife wants to come back, man, I believe you could do it. I believe you're that big of a God. I said, so I'm going to close my eyes. And if she wants to come back, bring her back.
Yeah.
And I closed my eyes. I waited for about 10 seconds. I opened my eyes. Of course, she didn't come back. But I didn't get mad at that. It wasn't like I was like ticked off. I just thought, okay, she didn't come back. And this is what's really weird.
Yeah.
Like, because I believe this is just my core belief. I believe what we do in our past every day, the things we put in our life, whether it's music, thoughts, actions that we do, those are seeds to prepare us for the future.
Mm-hmm.
Like everything I'm doing today is preparing me for something out in my future. So, you know, all of that, I guess some people would say religion, some people say Christianity, some people say faith, whatever we would label it. At least in that moment of hell, that came out of me.
Yeah.
Anger didn't come out of me. You know, I wasn't trying to go, you know, in just crazy mode. And I think a lot of times when we find ourselves in the ashes and, you know, we're kind of looking around like, what in God's name's going on here? My marriage is broken, my life, my kids, my business, I got fired, whatever that ash is for somebody. Mm-hmm. You know, what the ashes do, this is just my opinion again, what the ashes do is reveal the real us.
Right.
I mean, the moment the ashes are simmering around us, the real us comes out. You don't mm-hmm. fake it. It's the real raw. And so in that moment, I guess all those years of just being taught about God and hearing the Bible read, and I didn't really think I was that spiritual of a person, really. I mean, I loved God from what I thought I did. And I started singing a song. How weird is that?
Mm. What song?
I was looking at my dead wife and I just started singing the song, I worship you, almighty God, there is none like you. Mm. Don't even know. I give you praise for you are my righteousness. And I just sang that hymn. It's a hymn from years back. Yeah. And again, it's not like I had a playbook. You know, point number one, pray for the doctors. Point number two, pray that your wife comes back. Point number three, sing a song.
Mm-hmm.
Like there was no playbook. It's just happening all at once. But again, I think it was happening that way because my whole life I had been told when you're in a hellhole, pray.
Mm.
My whole life I had been taught that, hey, when all hell breaks loose, there's God.
Right.
So now that all hell's breaking loose and I'm in a hellhole, what had been put in my life as a kid was coming out naturally.
Yeah.
Because again, the ashes reveal the natural us, the real, you can't fake it anymore. You know, if you're faking God, when you hit the rock bottom, God doesn't come out because he's been fake the whole time. So I finished the song and I thought, all right, well, no reason to stay in here. I mean, this is kind of a miserable room to be in. So I put my hand on the doorknob. And I don't know what your listeners will think about this, right? This is just my story. But I put my hand on the doorknob, and when I put my hand on the doorknob, I heard a voice, not like audible, like I'm talking to you now, but inside, and it was so loud, it sounded audible. Mm-hmm. Like it was inside my, like I could hear it in my heart, you know, or I guess my head, and this is what the voice said. Do you think your wife would rather live with me in heaven or live with you on earth? And it happened so quickly and so loud, I literally thought somebody was talking to me.
Mm.
Because I just stopped dead in my tracks with my hand on the doorknob, and I heard that. And my answer was, well, come on, God, anybody would choose you over earth, you know, pick you to live in heaven versus earth. And I'm turning the doorknob, and I hear a second question, and it pops up. Do you think your wife would rather be married to me or married to you? And my actual comment back, because I was talking out loud in that room by myself, I said, come on, that's not a fair question. I said, anybody would choose you over me. And then I heard, fine, then the case is settled.
Hmm.
Move on.
What was your reaction?
I just thought the case is settled. She's not coming back. I can sit here for the next 20 years and cry about it and whine about it and pout about it, drink it away, cry it away, sleep it away, ignore it away, or I can just go ahead and admit the facts. And the facts are my wife is dead and she's not coming back and it hurts like hell. And no matter what I do, it's not going to change. Mm. So I might as well just enjoy the time we had and get busy living life.
Right.
Not that, and I think a lot of people don't like to do that because it feels like, well, if I get busy going about my life, I feel like I'm ripping the dead person off because I'm going to forget them or I'm going to not remember them. Or if I cry for about 8 months, it proves how much I really miss them. And I'm not saying I never cried anymore. I'm not saying it didn't bother me. I'm not saying that it didn't exponentially cause the fear to go up because now it's like death had come to my front door. You know, before death was just a thought and now death is a reality.
Now you're getting paralyzed from the fear that you set in.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, because before it's just a thought. You know, I can kind of make the thought go away, but now I can't ever make this go away.
Right.
I'm going to have to bury my wife. And, you know, and so 2 days later, or a day later, we did a really quick burial on the Saturday, just private family, nobody there, but she had a twin sister. Her family was there. My family was there. We're at the funeral at the graveside. And while we're at the graveside, I had her wedding ring and I had my wedding ring. And again, that voice, which I perceive to be God, I mean, some people may not think that's cool, but you know, from what I've perceived to be God, I heard a voice say, I want you to put her ring on the casket. And so I turned to my mom and I said, hey, mom, I said, I had a weird thought. And she said, what? I said, I'm supposed to put the wedding ring on Monica's casket. And she said, no. She said, why don't you keep it and melt it down and make a necklace out of it so you'll always have something to remember? And I was like, yeah, man, thank God for a mom. That's brilliant. I'll do that. I wasn't even thinking that. And so I just held onto the ring. And then my mother, just like I guess only a mom could do, she turned around and she said, no. She said, if that's what you heard in your heart, you do what you hear in your heart. And I said, okay. And so I took the wedding band off and I said to the funeral director, I said, hey, before you guys put the casket in the ground, can I just put this ring on her casket? And he said, oh, absolutely, Mr. Evans, you whatever you want to do. This is going to sound really weird. But I took the ring over and I was holding it in my hand and I held it above the casket and I'm having second thoughts like, should I do it? Should I not? And I thought, well, what is that old mentality? Don't ever quit, Mark. Keep moving. Keep going forward. Don't get stuck. Because I think a lot of people get stuck. Like we make progress a week or two and then we get stuck and we can't break out of it. You know, like something has to click to break us out of it. And sometimes that might be a friend. Sometimes it might be a coworker, a thought, a dream, something comes to initially push us out of the ashes. So here I am kind of like, okay, it's been a hellacious 2 days. I've had some weird things happen. So here we go. So I put the ring on the table, on the casket, and it just sounds weird. I don't mean it to sound weird, but it's just my story. And so I put the ring on the casket, and as soon as the metal touched the metal, I felt a wind come like over the area where we were sitting, like a real wind. And it just kind of blew over my life, like over my body. Like you especially notice it in South Georgia, right? It's May in South Georgia. So any kind of wind is much appreciated. And I just felt as soon as the metal touched the metal, I felt this wind come over me. Instantaneous. Every bit of guilt, pain, just left. I can't even explain it. I don't even know how to explain it. It's just like an instantaneous, the guilt left.
Inner peace.
Inner peace. That you can't drink it that way. You can't smoke it up that way. Like it was just a supernatural kind of moment. Like, oh my God, like something just happened.
Mm-hmm.
Because I find a lot of times when you're in the ashes, guilt is a powerful force.
Right.
You know, guilt is just you sorry. And that's the way I felt. Like for 24 hours, I just felt like I'm a sorry, terrible husband. Like the night before, I knew something was wrong. The night before, I felt it. Like there's something going on. I even said it in the mirror. And now I'm just feeling like a terrible, you know, you sorry, no good man. You didn't even know your wife was going to die. You didn't even kiss her goodbye. And now here comes all the guilt. As soon as I felt like, yeah, man, I feel good, it took about 3 seconds for the thoughts to come. Oh, it's not real. You're guilty. You're a terrible husband. You didn't love her the way she needed to be loved. You'll never be able to tell her you're sorry. You'll never be able to have another kiss. You'll never be able to tell her, you know. And so now here comes this barrage of guilt, right? Mm-hmm. So, and I think a lot of times guilt keeps people in the ashes. Because the guiltier I am, I feel justified to be guilty. Yeah, I am a terrible husband. I'm going to lay here another 3 years in the ashes because I'm so guilty. You know, I didn't love her the way she needed to be loved. I was all about me, you know, doing what I wanted to do. And, you know, now I'm like, oh, crap. I can't go back and apologize. I can't say I'm sorry. I can't tell her I'll be a better husband. So I'm laying in bed on Saturday night. And so she died on Friday, buried on Saturday. Now it's Saturday night. And I thought, okay, what could I do to make the guilt go away? And I felt the peace come, like she's dead. I'm good. I can move forward. I don't have to quit. But now the thoughts of fear, the thoughts of guilt. So I did what most people do. I made a bargain with God, you know, the whole human being going to bargain with God. And so I said, God, I said, I want to tell you something. I know I'm a sorry human, like, man, I'm terrible. I said, but if you will help me get through this, I swear to you, I will never play golf again. Right? How stupid, right? That's just a stupid. Because I love to play golf. I play basketball all the time, golf all the time. And, you know, and I just had this guilty thought, like I wasted a lot of time I could have spent with my wife on the golf course. Like I could have been a better husband, but no, I'm going to go play 4 and 5 hours of golf. And so I thought, what better way to just tell God I'm serious? Like, I want to be a better man. So I just said, God, I'm never going to golf again. You can count on me. I'm going to run hard after you. You know, this hell that came against me is just going to push me closer to God. So now I'm feeling kind of self-righteous, right? Mm-hmm. Like telling God he can count on you. So the next day we have the memorial service. There's about 700 people there. In the automobile with my wife was a pastor's wife, a baby, and a friend. And the pastor's wife had been really banged up as well and hurt. She was still in ICU. The baby died in the car wreck. So they were also having a funeral for the little baby girl that died. So we were doing both funerals at the same time, memorial services, not funerals. We were doing a memorial service for the pastor's wife and her baby that died, and we were doing the memorial service for my wife at the same time. So my pastor came from Alabama to do the memorial service, and the pastor's wife, her pastor came from Florida to do the memorial service. So I'd never met him. Like, I didn't know him from anything. And we're sitting on the front row, and he comes up first to do the memorial service for little baby Jordan. And I'm just sitting on the front row with my head down thinking, oh, man. I want to get through this day. And then all of a sudden, in the middle of him doing that, he stops and he says, Mark. And, you know, it's that moment of, oh, my God, is he talking to me? Because I wasn't even paying attention. And I sit up and I look at him and he's staring right at me. And he said, Mark. And I said, yes, sir. There's 700 people there now. He said, God told me to tell you to go golfing. And I just snot cried. Like, I had not told anybody.
Nobody at all.
I know, I'm laying in bed crying on Saturday night, you know, sobbing. And I tell God, because I'm such a pitiful human and a terrible husband, I'm never going to golf again. And a man I've never met in my life stopped in the middle of memorial service and said, Mark, God told me to tell you to go golfing. As soon as you leave this place, you go golf. And I was like, God almighty. You know, now I'm starting to have these weird thoughts like, God, and he is real. Yeah. He's not just some figment of my parents' religion. He's not just some, you know, crutch, because a lot of people feel like he's just a religion is a crutch, you know? And I'm like, oh man, like that's okay. One thing I'll say about that, that's definitely spiritual. Something's going on. So I did. I grabbed my golf clubs. My cousin was in town for the memorial service, and we went and golfed. You know, I can't say I did it happily. I can't say this is weird again, but every hole that I played, I found a little more freedom. Because I look back nearly 30 years now, and I realize coming out of the ashes is not always instantaneous.
Mm-hmm.
Coming out of the ashes a lot of times is a process of making good decisions, of surrounding yourself with people that believe in you, and taking risk. I mean, it's a risk to have your hand on a doorknob and hear a voice that says, would your wife rather be married to you or me? And so sometimes in the ashes, you have to answer some hard questions. What do you really believe? Because the ashes define who we are, and they define what we really believe.
Yeah.
You know, so here I am with my hand on a doorknob. It's defining, what do I really believe? Do I really believe God is real? Do I really believe he could talk to me? Do I really believe he cares about the hell I'm in that hospital room that day? And then the ring on the casket, do I really believe that if I do this, that something's going to happen, and I do it and something happens, peace comes, an inner peace. And then the next day, I'm not going to ever golf again. And a stranger that I've never met, who I've never talked to, says in front of 700 plus people, you need to go golf. And God told me to tell you that. And so I now believe that a lot of times coming out of the ashes is not a snap of a finger.
Right.
Why don't you just quit that or do this or like follow these rules? I think coming out of the ashes is an everyday decision. Like whatever I've got to do today, by God, I'm going to do it. And so on this day, I got to take my hand off a doorknob and answer a hard question. The next day, I've got to put a ring on a casket and believe and trust even when I don't want to. The next day, I got to go pay $50 to golf. But whatever it takes, because now here comes that mentality, I'm not going to quit.
Yeah.
You know, I cried through the golf course. I cried at night. But that mentality of, you know, learning that it's a process to step your way out of it.
Right.
So if that makes sense.
Yes, it does. It does, man. It's I appreciate you being vulnerable here. It's a lot to take in, the emotion and the distraught and everything you went through with all this. I can't imagine brokenheartedness and listening to God and having the faith to believe that he's talking to you right there. And then to go play golf, they have that continued healing. I just cannot even process the mindset that you had to go through with that to continue your life. But life goes on. 30 years later, you're here. What was the journey after all of this? We're going from A to K now.
Mm-hmm.
Some time has passed. You meet the lovely Robin. You guys raise up a new church. You have beautiful children. What is the journey, the cycle that goes from that past to this new family and new life and so on down the narrative?
You know, you say go from A to K here. I was sitting at a red light in June of 1989. And again, that voice of what I perceived to be God say, I want you to go back to school because I really felt like I would do ministry. And so I thought, well, to do ministry, I need to go to school and be trained. And, you know, that was my thinking. And so I did. I left and I ended up going to Tulsa, Oklahoma. And in Tulsa, Oklahoma, I met my wife now, Robin. And we married. And I don't think she knew she was probably marrying a mess. And when I say a mess, I mean, I was a good dude. Like I don't lose my temper. I was kind of like my dad, just real laid back. I love everybody. Like I'm the optimist in the room. I remember in college, the professor walked into my class one time and he said, I want everybody here to know, nobody in my class gets an A. I start everybody out with a C. And if you do good, I might give you a B. And he said, as a matter of fact, I don't hardly ever give out A's. Well, what does that do to the non-quitter? I was like, dude, I'm getting my A, right? Like, and so I even went up to him and I said, Professor, I really want to get an A. And he said, I don't give out A's. You have to earn it. I said, well, then I'll earn it. And I got an A. out of the class, there were two A's given and I got one of them. So that mentality of, man, nothing's going to stop me. I can do this. But at the same time, I have the I'm not going to quit attitude. I have all this garbage of mental duress and fear and life experiences that I learned to mask really well. Like, you walk in a room, I'm the eternal optimist. But in my heart, I'm over in the corner thinking I could die any minute. And so I didn't really share that with anybody. I didn't tell it to Robin. She marries me. We get married and, you know, just torment immediately because I immediately start thinking, what if she dies? She's going to die next. I've already buried one wife and God, what if she dies? So every time she would get in a car, I would just literally go into almost panic attack mode. Like, and especially once cell phones came out, you know, and everybody started getting cell phones. If she didn't call me, because she said, I will be at this place by 9 o'clock. And it was 9:04, panic. Like, oh God, she hadn't called me in 4 minutes. What's up? What if she's dead? What if she's on the side of the road? What if I don't know how to get to her? And then I would have to go all the way back to that 20, you know, that 1989 experience and relive it. Like, what if, what if, what if, what if, what if? But I faked it pretty good. I never forget riding down the road one day in Johnson City, Tennessee. We were riding down the road together. And she knew by now that her husband really struggles with stuff, fear, panic, anxiety, and debilitating, really. I could fake it real well, but man, I'd lay in at the house. I'd lay on the floor and cry. Like, I feel like I'm going to die. You're going to die. I can't shake the thoughts. I can't get them to go away. They'll never go away. I'll never forget what she said riding down the road. She said, Mark, she said, don't you think if the devil could have killed you, he would have killed you by now? And I mean, it just, I don't even know if it was a true thought, but whatever she said on that moment in that sentence, Mark, don't you think if the devil could have killed you, he would have killed you by now? And it was just the weirdest thing. Like, it was a snap of a finger. And I thought, yeah, you're right. Like, I don't have to. I don't have to fear the unknown. And that's what I began to realize is that I was just fearing the unknown. I was fearing tomorrow and tomorrow never happened. I was fearing a car wreck and the car wreck had never happened. I was just stuck. And I think that's what I began to understand is that a lot of times the fear, the anxiety, the experiences keep us stuck. We can't move forward. Because we're always afraid of what's going to happen. Because if it's happened once, it'll happen again. And so I just get stuck. It's no different than coming home and going, well, I made an F. And if I made an F, I'll probably make another one. But my dad said, no, you don't have to. We'll get over it. And I did. I ended up making a B in the class. It's like the professor, you'll never make an A. And yet I stepped over it and made the A. That mentality's coming back of, I'm just not going to get stuck. And I feel stuck. Like, I can't get the thoughts to go away and I feel stuck. And then she says that, and it's like a snap of a finger. It didn't totally get me out, but it pushed me. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like I said a minute ago, it was another step in the ashes to go, oh God, you're right. Like, I'm fearing stuff that has never even happened. I'm fearing hypothetical things. And then suddenly it's just my whole world opened up. Like, most of my fears are just hypothetical. They're what ifs. What if, what if, what if, what if? I couldn't go into hospitals because what if? I couldn't watch shows on TV about emergency rooms. What if? And then fast forward, you know, you said A to K, I'll go LMNOP now. I have two children. What does a parent that has anxiety of fear and death do? You check your kids every day. Every night they would go to sleep, I would get up and rub them and, you know, are they breathing? Are they okay? And I'll never forget Robin saying, what are you doing? You don't wake up a sleeping baby. And you just, you know, waking them up and now they're crying. But yet the anxiety in me was like, no, I've got to check them because what if they die? And I need to make sure that they don't have crib death and, you know, sleep them on their side, their left side, their right side, their back or their front. Oh God, what if we do the wrong thing? I was laying in bed one night, so I'm taking steps, you know, the step with the ring, the doorknob, the ring, the wind, the golf, the, you know, hey, if the devil could kill you, he would. So your thoughts are erratic all over the place. And now this came really hit home. I was laying in bed and I was so tormented. Like, I'm going to get up and check the baby. And Robin said, what are you doing? I said, I want to go check the baby. And she said, no, don't go wake Olivia up. And I said, yeah, but what if? And she said, Mark, you just got to trust God sometimes. I knew that, right? I know you got to trust God, but I want everybody else to trust God, not me. I want to trust me. I can rely on me. And so I said, okay, you're right. I just got to trust God. So I said, all right, I'm going to trust him. And then the next thought was, your kid's going to die tonight because you trusted God. You need to get up and go check on her. So I rolled out of bed and I put my feet on the floor and I thought, no, I'm not getting out of bed. I'm going to lay back down. I did that for about 4 hours. Mm-hmm. You're probably wondering why I'm not in a psych hospital.
You're plagued.
Yeah. Wow. And so I just finally thought, no, I am going to trust God. I'm going to lay here and trust God. And so that was, you know, the fall of 1993. So 4 years in, tormented, the fall of 1993, I thought, no, next step out of the ashes is sometimes you just got to trust God when you can't even figure it out. So I'm just going to lay here and trust him. And guess what happened? Woke up the next day, my kid's perfectly fine. Hmm. I woke up this morning, she's still perfectly fine. I'm 54, she's in her late 20s, still perfectly fine. Because I realized to come out of the ashes, sometimes life doesn't make sense. You just got to trust God when it doesn't make sense and take another step. And so there's my next step out of the ashes. And then it got a little deeper because I'm still having the fear and anxiety. And I called my dad one day. I said, Dad, you got to pray for me. He said, what do you need, son? He lived in Atlanta and I was in Tennessee. I said, these thoughts of fear that won't go away, they won't leave me alone. He said, well, son, what are you afraid of? And I said, well, I'm afraid I'm going to have a heart attack. And he said, a heart attack? I said, yes, sir. He said, well, why would you have a heart attack? Your whole family's healthy. I'm healthy. Your grandparents lived a long life. I said, I don't know, Dad. It just over and over and over, I'm going to die. He said, well, what are you afraid to do? I said, like, I love running and I'm afraid if I run, I'm going to have a heart attack. He said, well, I'll tell you what you ought to do. Get your tennis shoes on right now. Hang up the telephone, put your shoes on and go run. And I was like, what? And he said, as soon as you hang up for me, put your tennis shoes on and go for a run. I said, did you hear what I just said? Like, I'm scared to go run. Because what if I have a heart attack while I'm running? He said, did you hear what I said? Put your shoes on. I'm in my mid-20s, right? I mean, I'm a grown man. He says, put your shoes on, go out and run. And he said, every time you think you're going to die, you just tell yourself, I'm not going to die. I'm going to live and not die. I was like, okay, you're my dad. I guess I'll do that. Better than just sitting here crying. So 304 Green Valley Drive is where I live. I hung up the phone. I put my ASICS running shoes on. I laced them up and I thought, well, I guess I'll just run a 3 mile run. I went down the end of the driveway. The first thought I heard, you're going to die on this run. There were no cell phones then. You're going to die. Nobody's going to know where you are. You're going to find yourself over in a ditch having a heart attack. Your wife's not even going to know what way you ran. And I just thought, you know, here I go. And so I remember just starting to run and I could hear my feet. Poof, 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 poof. And the whole time poof, 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 in my head, I was going, I will live and not die. I will live and not die. I will live and not die in cadence with my feet. I did that for 3 miles and I got back home and I thought, God, I lived and I didn't die. How profound, right?
Yeah.
Like I made it. And so that was another step out of the ashes that sometimes you got to face your biggest fear. Sometimes you just got to look it dead in the eye and go, no, I'm not. I'm going to put my shoes on, face my biggest fear, and I'm going to go out and conquer this thing.
Yeah.
And every single day I put my shoes on. Sometimes I did good, and other days I'd be at mile 5, mile 7. I will live and not die. And, you know, I would do it every single time. And so, you know, to come out of the ashes, there's another step. I had to learn to trust God when I couldn't figure it out. Now, my next step is, well, grow up, big boy, because now you're going to have to face that fear. Mm-hmm. And here comes that fear right in your face, okay? And so I think now I'm no longer laying in the ashes. I just kind of have ash on my feet because I'm making progress. So fast forward a few years later, I was doing a vacation Bible school with a friend of mine. We for a bunch of kids. There's about 150 kids. And he and I were leading it as we did this little dorky skit called Ned and Skeeter Finkerman. We were old farmers and we just made kids laugh for a whole hour. And so I'm coming out to get ready to do this big production in front of these 150 kids. And I hear that voice again. And here's what it said. You're going to die in front of all of these kids. You're going to look stupid. Immediately the panic attack came. And that's before there was internet. Like I couldn't go on the internet and Google what is a panic attack. I didn't even know what a panic attack was. I just knew I felt like I'm about to die. I feel like I'm going to die in front of these kids. My heart starts racing. I start breaking out in a sweat. And I thought, well, that no quitter mentality, man, I'm not quitting. I'm just going to go in there. If I die in front of the kids, I die in front of the kids. Here we go. I didn't even tell my friend. We just went and we did it. We went through the whole program. It ended. And I immediately ran back to my office where my office was. I sat down on my desk. I put my head on a Blue Vines expository dictionary. I'm crying. The room is spinning. I think I'm going to die. This is the night I'm going to die. So I picked up a roto dial phone and I dialed my mom's number. I said, Mom, you got to pray for me. Something's going on. And she said, son, what is it? I said, I really feel like I'm going to die. Like I'm having a death thought. It's like this is the end of my life. And she said, no. She said, I rebuke that fear over you. She said, you will not have fear. And that's a strange thing to hear a mother say that, right? Like, I rebuke that fear. I wish you would have just said, do you need a donut? Do you need you need mama to come over and make you some meatloaf? You know, something that'll help a brother out.
Yeah.
And as soon as she said, no, I rebuke that fear. Like, this is going to sound weird to you guys. I literally felt like 1,000 pounds was lifted off my shoulders. I just felt like, phew. And I was like, God, I started sobbing and crying. And then you remember I grew up as a Christian in a Christian home. So I never had the stories of I was in drugs. I was hooked on these things and this. I just grew up in a good home. And I remember having the thought, this must be what it feels like when people say they've been born again. Like I literally felt like a light as a feather. Like I felt like every thought, every bit of anxiety, just snap of a finger was gone. And I remember having the thought, this is what people mean when they say they've been born again. Like, this is, has to be what that feels like. Because I'd never felt anything. I just grew up in church and I always heard people talk about it. I was this way and then I met Jesus and now I'm this way. And so for 2 weeks, for the first time since 1989, this is about 1995. Actually, it was July 31st, 8:20 p.m., 1995. On the phone with my mother. And I said, oh, Mom, and this is what she said. She said, son, I want you to write it down. I want you to draw a line in the sand that this night fear stops and will never again have a right in your life. I said, yes, ma'am. She said, you go get a post-it note and write it down. I said, yes, ma'am. So I got a post-it note and I wrote on there, on July the 31st, 1995, 120 Cornerstone Drive, Johnson City, Tennessee, at 8:20 p.m. with my head on a Blue Vines expository dictionary, I called my mother and she prayed for me. And based on Matthew 18, 18 and 19, if any two of you agree on earth is touching anything, it will be done by God in heaven. And I wrote that on a post-it note. I folded it up and I put it in my wallet. And she said, every time you feel a fearful thought coming on, I want you to remind yourself that you drew a line in the sand, that it will follow you no more. I thought, that's stupid, but okay, I'll try it. I've tried everything else. Why not this? So July 31st, 8:20 p.m., 1995, 120 Cornerstone Drive with my head on a Blue Vines expository dictionary, Matthew 18, 18 and 19, I got delivered of fear and I will never let fear have any more right voice over my life. At work for 2 weeks. 2 weeks, I'm driving down the road and I hear, you're going to die. You're going to have a car wreck. You know what I did? This is going to sound stupid. I rolled the window down and I screamed at the top of my voice out the window driving down the highway. No! July 31st, 8:20 p.m., 1995, 120 Cornerstone Drive with my head on a Blue Vines expository dictionary on the phone with my mother, Matthew 18, 18 and 19. I got delivered from fear and I will never let this thing. And immediately the thought left me. And I thought, all right, I'm on to something here. And I wrote a book about this experience called Fireflies on the Bedpost. And one of the chapters is you have to draw a line in the sand.
Right.
Because a lot of times we never come out of the ashes because it becomes our identity. We never rise above the ashes because the ash becomes who I am. The fear controls me. I turn into the fear. The pain controls me. I just turn into the pain. The people that did me wrong control me, and I just turn into a lot of regret and anger, and I self-identify with the ash. Now I don't rise above the ash. I just make a home in it. I make myself as comfortable as I can in my ashes, and it becomes my identity. And I learned something that walking myself out of this thing is, it was a 20-year process. But whoever's listening today, I can assure you, it might not always be a snap of a finger. You come out of the ashes, you may be in a hellhole of a problem. But if you'll just every day wake up and go, today I'm going to do something that takes me one step further. And so now I find myself drawing a line in the sand. Fast forward now 10 years beyond that. I'm laying in bed one night. We have four daughters now. I'm laying in bed, and all of a sudden I come up out of a dead sleep. And my wife says, what's wrong? And you know what I said? Rather than, I think I'm going to die, I'm having a panic attack, here it comes. She said, what's wrong? I said, nothing. I said, I'll be right back. She said, where are you going? I said, I'm going over here by the couch on the other side of the bedroom. There's something I have to take care of. She said, okay. And so she rolled over, and I walked over to the side of the couch, and I knelt down on the bedroom floor. And this is what I said. I was having every thought, I'm going to kill you, I'm going to kill your wife, I'm going to kill your children. And I quietly kneeled down on the floor. I put my head on the couch and I said, July 31st, 8:20 p.m., 1995, 120 Cornerstone Drive, with my head on a Blue Vines Expository Dictionary, on the phone with my mother, Matthew 18, 18, 19, and 20, I got delivered from fear, and you will never, ever, ever again cause my life to be in torment. And immediately the thought left, and I went back over and laid in bed. Because I learned that coming out of the ashes, you finally have to come to a place to draw a line in the sand and say, enough's enough. I can pout the rest of my life, cry. I can go back to the hurt, back to the moment, back to the bottle, back to the medicine, and keep running back to my security, running back to my security blankets and all the things that I've become accustomed to. Or I can say, you know what? Enough's enough.
Yeah.
I'm going to quit pouting, quit blaming people, quit. And that's what I said at the very beginning. Sometimes you just have to know what to quit.
Right.
And I'm quitting that. I'm drawing a line in the sand. So there may be somebody listening, you know, on one side, the mark that says, I'll never quit. And on the other side, I'm looking at it going, no, I'm definitely quitting this. I'm going to draw a line in the sand to these thoughts. I'm going to draw a line in the sand to this, the way I've been identifying, and I'm moving forward. Yeah. And I sit here in front of you today. What is 2019?
Yeah.
You know, that's 30 years later from May 19th, 30 years later. And I can say, yeah, man, God brought me out of the ashes one step at a time. I wish it was overnight. I wish he would have just picked me up, hosed me off and said, get busy living. It was a 20 plus year process. And I can say it word. And I wrote a book about it.
Right.
I wrote a book on how to come past the what if, because I have a whole chapter called the what if scenarios. It's the questions. What if, what if, what if, what if? You know, and one of them is if you want a life, you need to get a plan. Because I think sometimes coming out of the ashes, it's not all about luck. It's about a plan, you know.
Well, let me ask you this. Do you feel like that people can take these same principles and utilize that for, let's just say, addictions, you know, drugs, porn, this, that, the other? Or, you know, if somebody's just dead, you know, dead on the ground, just like just dying inside because life is just beating them up. And they take these same principles, you know, just drawing that line in the sand and just stop right there and move forward with their life and never look back. Do you feel like that's something that can be accomplished in any arena outside of being, you know, fearful of death or something that's coming over you, like a panic attack or whatnot, anxiety like you experienced? But can people draw that line in other avenues of despair?
Yes. And I say that confidently because I've really thought about it, because otherwise it seems very unfair, because you'd be like, well, it seems like maybe God liked Mark better than me, or maybe Mark had a better break in life than me, or Mark had better upbringing than me. So therefore, Mark can come out of his ashes because he had a better chance to. Not me. I was screwed over by my family. I was done wrong. I didn't have the friends. I didn't have the faith. I didn't know God. I didn't have the people to help me. I didn't have a mom I could call. I didn't have a dad I could call. And so it's easy to all of a sudden self-identify again with all the blame. So here's my answer. Is it possible? Yes, if you quit blaming things.
Right.
Is it possible? Yes, if you'll get up every day and treat every day as a new day, not as the same hell you woke up from. Every day is a brand new day. Is it possible? Yes, it's possible if you believe that you can come out of it. Yes, it's possible to draw a line in the sand. Anybody can do it. Anybody can say, I'm done with the drugs. I'm drawing a line in the sand right now, today, in August of 2019. The question that really helped me that I think I would share back to anybody is never negate the power of people who walk the journey with you.
Mm-hmm.
Because there's nothing worse than feeling alone.
Right.
Because everybody can draw a line. Everybody can follow the rules. Everybody can do the 12 steps. Everybody can have enough chutzpah. Some people do better than others, right?
Yeah.
But the one thing we're all gifted at is quitting and having a bad day. And I've had them. And I think the beauty of friendship, and I think the beauty of God and the way God designed us is it just is so nice to have people that are like, I'm not going to enable you. I'm going to empathize with you. But my whole goal of being in your life is to get you out of the ashes. Yeah. My goal is not to come in the ashes and build a sandcastle. Yeah. It's to get you out of it. And so, yes, my answer is yes. If you have that, it's sure possible.
Yeah, it's so important to have a tribe of like-minded people to help you, to grab you up the ladder. If they're above you and they look down, you're fearful. You can't get up there. They grab you by the hand. They pull you above them. Next thing you know, you're above them. You look down. They're right there below you. You lift your hand down. You grab them, pick them up, put them above you. It's kind of like you're pulling each other up this ladder, whether you want to call it a ladder of success or a ladder of life or whatever, but you're trying to help each other up that ladder. Do you see any synergy there with like-minded people that help you, like maybe your mom and dad that got you through that? Do you feel like that community was a big part of you overcoming?
Oh, absolutely. And it's that way anywhere. Any kind of addiction relief you go through, whether it's alcohol, drugs, everybody's going to tell you the same thing. You got to have the tribe. Yeah. You got to have the people that are coming along that are not enabling you. The problem is in the ashes when I'm there, rather than looking to get out, I find all the other people in the ashes. And then we just build a fire and hang out and tell our sob stories. So I think to get out of the ashes, I've got to have somebody to go, dude, come on, here we go. Whether that's a friend or whatever. And I think that is a powerful concept. And a lot of times from a Christian perspective, we don't help people get out of the ashes because we just get in the ashes with them and try to help them endure the ashes. Mm-hmm. Versus really what you're doing, really inspiring people to rise above it. Don't just make the best of it. You know, don't just smile while you're in the ashes. You know, it's okay to cry while you're in the ashes and feel miserable. So let's get out of it. And here's the plan. And here's how you can do that. So, which was why I wrote the book. I wrote the book and thought, well, if I got out, maybe it could work. I've got a friend in here with us today, Justin, and he was struggling with some things in his life. And, you know, we've been friends for years. And just in a joking way, I kind of laughed. I said, hey, bro, you read my book yet? He's like, no. I said, good, why don't you try it? And I gave him a copy. He called me 2 days later. He said, dude, I got to the chapter of draw the line in the sand. I want you to know I drew my line in the sand. And he came back and he said, man, I found freedom. I had another guy come to me and said, man, Mark, could you pray for me? I'm like, yeah, what's going on? He said, I'm addicted to porn.
Yeah.
I said, dude, okay. I said, let me help you with something. He said, what? I said, I'm not just going to pray for you. At the end of my prayer, I want you to draw a line in the sand that porn will never again be part of your life. And he just looked at me like I was stupid. And I said, no, really try it. I said, as a matter of fact, why don't you do this? Write it down on a post-it note when I prayed and what you decided to do. He said, okay. And so he did it. And I said, and then call me back when you see it works. He called me back about 3 weeks later. I said, dude, how are you doing? He said, man, I hadn't looked at porn since. He said, the moment I drew the line in the sand, it gave me hope. And that's what I tell people is most people stay in the ashes because they become hopeless. Mm-hmm. I've already tried this. I tried that. I tried this. I tried that. And I tried that too. I prayed. It didn't work. And you just get hopeless. Mm-hmm. A chapter in the book says if you're breathing, there's hope.
Yeah.
Because I think hope is a great thing, you know? And so I will say, to answer your question, does it work? Maybe not step by step methodically, but right. The principles do.
Yeah.
The principles behind it of being willing to take those steps, being willing to risk it, being willing to push forward and not give up and not quit. Yes.
Yeah. Well, that's what I've seen about you. When you're preaching, you like to slow people down. You're really good. A leader, you like to make people laugh, but you like to slow people down to make them think, to let the cognitive awareness come out where they can slowly like see themselves in what you're speaking about. And when they see themselves and identify themselves in these situations, there is, maybe it's not a methodical process, but it's a process that whereas they can, you know, if they were going about their lives and they were at the point where they couldn't, they just kept on living life. They didn't slow down. Like you allow people to really become aware of where they're going, what they're doing, what they can do, how they can overcome, how they can achieve and move on up the ladder. That's what this podcast is all about. It's all about, you know, helping people rise above the ashes, to slow them down, to listen to the stories, the raw grittiness, the darker version of the chicken soup for the soul, to allow people to get to the next level. And that's what you're doing. You're through your book. I read it. It's a great book. You're allowing people to slow down, to become cognitive, to understand that there is, to understand that if you are fully aware, you can overcome anything. I think people just get busy with life.
Sure.
They get intoxicated with how they're living. The drunk keeps on drinking, the weed smoker keeps on smoking, the druggie, the porn, the this, the that. They just kind of get self-absorbed and they don't slow down to realize that community can help them overcome, that people can and really help. And then they don't slow down to realize that stuff works. Mm-hmm. Like they just become absorbed. And I think that's the identifying theme. Like after doing several of these podcast, most people just don't slow down to become aware. And I just wanted to tell you, I appreciate you
sure
and
thing,
everything
yeah.
that you preach. And it's a blessing for me. And this is my life's mission, to inspire, educate, and give people hope. And you're giving people hope every day. And your book is amazing. I know you've got to go soon. So let's just wrap up with some rapid fire questions.
Sure.
And I appreciate you being so vulnerable with the tragedy you experienced in life and things like that. What do you feel like is your greatest success?
My greatest success is that my kids have grabbed a hold of faith.
Yeah.
And they're all adults. And I find the fact that I never made them, I never forced them to read their Bibles, I never forced them to love God. I just lived it mm-hmm. and the best I could. And so now I look at all my daughters, they're grown, they're in college, nursing school, graduated college, running businesses. And I look at that and go, all right, man, my greatest success is I pass my faith to my kids, you know, and I know by doing that, you know, when life kind of comes at them, I see them turning to God rather than turning to all the other things the world offers us.
Right, right. What do you feel like is your most recent failure that you've overcome, whether it's little or large? Small or large?
How recent? How you want to talk about yesterday or your
last week? Well, you know, we're failing every day. Everybody has always got some kind of obstacle before them.
But, last week, we had a great Sunday at church. I mean, it was just a wonderful day. 27 new people joined, right? Okay. And in the 27 new people joining, I got a text a couple of hours later that told me I was the worst pastor that they had ever had in their entire life. I was a hypocritical liar. I didn't love people. And I'm at home going, God, am I that bad of a human? Like, oh. And so, you know, I've often learned in life that it's easy. You know, you're never going to please everybody. As hard as I try to love people, as hard as I try to be a friendly dude and just, man, I genuinely, I think the people that know me closest, I genuinely love everybody. Like I like people. And my wife even laughs. She says, man, one of your greatest strengths is you love people and your greatest weakness is you love people because I just love everybody. But, you know, to get hurt, you know, we're still emotional. It doesn't matter how spiritual we are or whatever, how strong mentally, hurts still come. You know, a few weeks ago, you know, just had to deal with, hey, are we going to have enough money to pay payroll? You know, just life.
Yeah.
And, you know, you can either sit and pout and go, am I wasting my time, my energy? And it's like, no, I'm going to keep running my mission. You know, that's what I met with our team. And I said, hey, I want you to look at this text, you know, and they all read it. And they're like, really? Gosh, you know, even my best friends, I let a few of them read it. Like, man, you guys check me as you know, am I really? I don't want to live that way. I don't want to come across fake. And they're like, man, we've known you for years. And, you know, so I think the biggest failures are just learning we're always emotional people. Mm-hmm. And in any given moment, we're going to have to fight through things that discourage us. And so I would say just fight, man. Go back when you feel discouraged, go back to your life mission. And my life mission is relationship and discipleship.
Okay, perfect. What's your favorite movie or documentary or and why?
My favorite movie is The Godfather. I would watch it a million times over, coupled with Saving Private Ryan. Okay. I love them both. Okay. I mean, they're right in my wheelhouse.
Right, right. What's the best advice you give your 30-year-old self?
Best advice I give my 30-year-old self, chill out and trust God.
Give me three words you would come up with to promote to the youth of today. Like something I would come up with is redemption, forgiveness, hope. What's three words you would put on a billboard and say, like, chase after this?
Simple. I did this in 2012 when we moved to Atlanta to take the church here, Love Power Community. And I thought about them hard. Yeah. And I picked them not because I wanted a church mission. I picked them because they had changed my life. And love meaning love people, love God with all your heart, love people like yourself. Teaching people Jesus loves them. Power simply means not just, you know, willpower, but Holy Spirit, you need help. So when I say the word power, I literally mean everybody needs help. And it's a help that's higher than us. And then the last word is community. We all were birthed and born and bred for relationship. Yeah. So if I made it a little less spiritual for people on that billboard, I would say love, spiritual power, you know, people would call a higher power, and then friendship. Mm-hmm. They're just critical. Yeah.
Well, I think that's a perfect wrap up for this podcast. I do thank you, Mr. Mark Evans.
And thanks for having me.
Yeah, where can people find you?
They can find me at mybelieverschurch.com. So just go there and all of our info is there. Mybelieverschurch.com. Church is in Douglasville. And then the book is called Fireflies on the Bedpost and it's on Amazon.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much. Have a wonderful outing today, doing whatever you're doing. And we will talk to you soon. Thank you for listening to Rise Above the Ashes, the podcast. Please subscribe to the show on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts. Learn more at our website at riseabovetheashes.com.